Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. In this special episode, we take a look back at some of our favorite moments from the top episodes of our two ongoing series, Nation of Writers and AWM Author Talks. We'll kick it off with the top five episodes of Nation of Writers. In this monthly series, we dive into the life and legacy of an influential writer of the past by speaking with contemporary writers and scholars who have been impacted by their work. We begin with the late, great Cormac McCarthy, who passed away in June of this year at the age of 89. For July's episode of Nation of Writers, we spoke with authors Amit Majmudar and Fernando A. Flores about McCarthy's influence on them. In this clip, the two discuss McCarthy's wild stylistic range.
Cormac McCarthy's language, like, to me, is very, like, clinical to me. You know, it's very precise, you know, just like that kind of language, like clinical kind of language, just gets to the point and it tells you exactly, like, what needs to happen, you know? So he kind of, like, to me, I always think about that's the word that comes to mind when I'm reading his prose, you know, when I'm revisiting it, you know. And I say that in a positive way, you know, in a very positive way.
It's kind of like which Cormac McCarthy you're talking about, because I can think of books by Cormac McCarthy where he's being very spare, stark, clinical, and very often very simple sentences and things like that. And then there's Blood Meridian, where he just takes the regulator off. And he just lets it flow, and it's purple passage after purple passage, you know? And there's like that description of like the mules falling off the side of the mountain, and they've got mercury in the sacks, and the mercury turns into these balls, and the balls of mercury curl. It's completely unnecessary, all that description. And like, and yet he just does it. And there have been books by McCarthy that I've read where I'm like, do the Blood Meridian thing again, you know, like go off, you know, go off. And like, but he was just capable of, you know, and that's something that we talk about McCarthy's style, or, you know, McCarthy being a certain way. But what was very interesting is that he had one of the largest stylistic ranges of any writer that I'm familiar with, to be honest with you, within the field of prose. Because even if you look at, you know, his last novel, Stella Maris, he's got all these passages about the science, about sciences and physics and things like that.
Wow.
And you juxtapose that kind of stuff where he's talking about, you know, nuclear bombs and Oppenheimer and Hiroshima and the science of it and mathematics. He's talking about all this complex mathematical stuff. And then you juxtapose that with some of the passages of thick description in Blood Meridian, which are super poetic, and then some of the stark, you know, pared down violent scenes in No Country for Old Men. And it's hard to just keep all that in your mind at one time and say this all came out of the same guy, and it's all kind of peak examples of that kind of writing. And when you try and think to yourself, okay, did all, you know, other famous writers, did Philip Roth ever do that? Did Updike ever pull that off? Did David Foster Wallace ever pull that off? Did whoever, you name it, did they ever pull that kind of range off? And my answer would be, if they did, I haven't seen it yet. You know what I'm saying? And you know, even, and you can even go further back and say, look, Tolstoy, Proust, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody had this kind of range. Very unusual. Very unusual.
For June's episode of Nation of Writers, we discussed the legacy of Ursula K. Le Guin with her son, Theo Downs Le Guin, and science fiction and comics author Charlie Jane Anders. In this clip, they'll discuss the importance of Le Guin's thought experiments on gender and the power of writerly imagination to change the world at an individual level.
Her thought experiments around gender, and not just The Left Hand of Darkness, but a bunch of her other books, remain really salient and remain really important. And I know that they have inspired a whole generation of authors now, from, you know, Anne Leckie to countless trans and queer authors, to play around with gender and to kind of try and imagine how gender and families and social relations involving, you know, concepts of male, female, and other, how those could be different. I think that Le Guin's, a huge part of her impact on the field today does come from her willingness to kind of go counterfactual when it comes to gender.
To imagine, you know, we were just talking about imagination, right? To imagine
other options, right? Absolutely, for sure.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to add, Theo?
I could talk about my mother all day. So I was thinking about what Charlie Jane just said, and, you know, not only to inspire and in a sense permit subsequent generations of writers to experiment and rethink things around gender, but also just to provide that for readers in their own lives as well. So, I have spoken with many readers who aren't writers who have seen in The Left Hand of Darkness and Ursula's other writing on gender a path forward for their own lives that they might not have found as quickly or in the way they did had it not been for reading that. So again, speaking to the power of writerly imagination to change the world at an individual level.
Mm, yeah, well said.
February found us chatting with best-selling author Tiari Jones and scholar and professor Lindsay Stewart about the life and writing of the iconic Zora Neale Hurston. In this clip, Jones gives reasons why she recommends reading Hurston's work today.
Like, if I was talking to a high school student who may be a reluctant reader, I would definitely tell the reluctant reader, you know, do it for the plot, just for the good time of it. Back to Black Joy, there's so much pleasure in the experience of reading it. And I think this is something that is under-discussed when talking about African-American literature. Our work is so often talked about, like, eat your vegetables, learn about the world, instead of just the sheer page-turnery about how Janie left her three husbands. Like, if somebody leaving three husbands, that's something you can read on your vacation if you want. So, I mean, there's that. And then there's other people, you would tell them to read it just like if I was telling someone who was a writer, I definitely would have them read Hurston to look at the way she privileges in getting the language just right and how the challenge of trying to capture how people talk on the page. That's because it can't, you know, what does Morrison say, that language is an approximation? And how close she gets in her approximation. So that's one reason. And then I think the nonfiction, I would have someone read it just to think about, because it's still relevant to how we look at the experiences that we're having today. And how do you still tell your experience and document your pleasure, even in the midst of the horrific time in which we find ourselves?
To celebrate Walt Whitman's birthday in May, we spoke with poet Rosanna Young Oh and staff members from the Walt Whitman Birthplace Association about his enduring legacy in helping to define a unique American voice. In this clip, they discussed the writers and orators who influenced and inspired Whitman.
To me, I think a lot of what we're talking about or thinking about when we talk about Whitman is his voice. I don't think it's you can't imitate it. And a lot of it, the cadence comes from his exposure to those sermons, you know? So I think that probably had to do a lot with his process, the oratory element to his work.
Yeah, there was something called the Lyceum Movement in the early 19th century. And it was a way to get an education by attending lectures of learned people. And one of the important influences on Whitman, of course, was Ralph Waldo Emerson, was a congregational preacher at one point, having grown up in Boston right near Harvard. And I gave a series of lectures called Modern Times. And there was a lecture in particular called The Poet, and Whitman, as a journalist, attended that lecture. And I guess the 1960s expression would be it expanded his consciousness. It set him off on the path. He wanted to be the person that Ralph Waldo Emerson was seeking to represent American society and not just imitate European language and style. And he was inspired by Emerson and the Transcendentalists to depict the real America. And this was an important influence on him.
And then there's that famous letter that Whitman got from Emerson.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was the beginning of a great career, right? Which caused a little conflict between them for a while, but they both mutually respected each other at the end.
Right. And then Emerson's lecture that you mentioned, The Poet, I have the quote right here, "For it is not meters, but a meter making argument that makes a poem." And that kind of explains some partially what Whitman's project was about in envisioning this American democracy, this free verse movement, I will call it.
Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, if you look at Wolf and his influences, it would have to be Elias Hicks through his family relationship. His grandfather was a hunting companion of the young Elias Hicks. They both used to hang out in the woods on Long Island and shoot things, I imagine. And then his father had a respect for Elias Hicks' message, I guess you call it. And Walt said he attended a lecture with his parents. And so the Friends, a Society of Friends or Quakers, and the Transcendentalist thinking, how there was a spark of the divine in every living being, okay, had an influence on his thinking, and that led him to value, I suppose it leads you to think he valued the common person because they too had that spark. And so he tried to elevate that to an art form.
For January's episode of Nation of Writers, we discussed the life and work of Chicago legend Nelson Algren. In this clip, co-founder of the Nelson Algren Museum at Miller Beach, Sue Rutzen, and Algren scholar Richard F. Bales discuss how Algren spent his life championing the downtrodden and fighting for them with his writing.
And of course, after realizing he spent his entire life, I think, fighting for injustice. And of course, the Hollywood 10, you know, the Hollywood 10. That was during, of course, the height of the Cold War, when people in Hollywood were being asked to again name names and to say that they weren't communists, and some people said, like Gary Cooper and Ronald Reagan, said, "Sure, we'll testify." Well, 10 directors and movie actors refused to testify, saying, "Look, it is my constitutional right to remain silent," and in return, they went to prison, and then they were blacklisted afterwards, Bettina Drew interviewed, I think it was Albert Maltz, I think, when she was writing her book in 1984, and he was part of the Hollywood 10, and he said when everybody else was running away, Algren was out there in front, championing us. That is so cool.
Yeah. And another thing is that, you know, that Algren, Bettina Drew said this at one of our conferences, she said, "Algren teaches me about compassion." And that is, I think, the main word in Algren is compassion. And if you go back to his early life, you know, he graduated from the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, in 1931 with a journalism degree. And he could not find a job for love or money. So he rode the rails and he lived like a hobo. And he was hungry, he was beaten, he saw horrible things on the rail. And then he ended up, Saul Ross University allowed him to use their typewriter in Alpine, Texas. And so when he left that area, he realized he had no typewriter at home. And so he decided he would just pick up this Royal Upright, address it to his parents, and send it off on the Union Pacific Railroad. Well, he was arrested within a couple hours and thrown in jail, where he stayed for at least, well, some people say 3 weeks, some 4 weeks, waiting trial. And in that time, he is sleeping on cement floors. He's seeing a man, a prisoner who died because he didn't get the most rudimentary medical care. And the jailers were psychopaths, and his fellow jail people in jail with him were psychopaths also. But he's only like 24 years old. So this was a horrible, horrible experience for him that he never forgot. And he always put a jail scene in his 5 novels. So, you know, he has compassion for the guy on the street who doesn't have socks and he can't find anything to drink, and he's cold, he's hungry, there's nowhere to sleep. He cares about, he wants us to care about people like that.
Now, onto the top 5 episodes of our other podcast series, AWM Author Talks. The next five episodes were all recorded live at the inaugural American Writers Festival, which returns to Chicago on May 19th, 2024. Our first featured episode is a panel discussion about comedy writing with Christella Alonso, Karen Shee, Peter Gwynn, Alexandra Petri, and Peter Sagal. In this clip, Gwynn and Alonso discuss the age-old question, how do you know what's funny?
Okay. Second question, how do you know what's funny?
Peter, go first.
I'm sorry, wrong Peter.
I have an answer for that, actually. Please. Because it circles back to the thing that made me so angry at Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
That's the show that was one of Aaron Sorkin's few failures. It was a show about a show very much like Saturday Night Live and all the backstage drama.
Yeah, and there's a moment in the pilot of that show where there's a gap in the show and we need to fill it, and what are we going to do? And the boss is played by Matthew Perry, and a writer comes in and is like, I think I've got it. I've got the missing 2 minutes. And he takes the script and he goes, this is funny. And I went, no, it wasn't, because you didn't laugh. And that's the answer. You know it's funny if it makes you laugh. Now, I get what they were saying, that we're all like jaded people who've seen everything, but still, like, at least your eyes smile.
Right.
Like, something like, you know, something gives you a little twist feeling and you laugh and smile at it. And that's just how you know. There are other things where you like, oh, this is the format of a joke, but is not funny.
Right.
This might get a laugh from an alien that did not speak Earth language just because of its pattern and the noises it makes, but you're gonna feel that, and you feel that when you're writing. The best thing in the world is when you write a joke and then you laugh at your own joke on the computer.
You laugh at your own jokes?
Yes.
That's impressive. To me, because, you know, I ended up getting a TV show based on my life. So for me, stand-up, what I learned was that everything that was funny to you was going to be funny. And that was the problem with a lot of people, that when we started, so many of us were trying to write what we thought people would laugh at. And there's a difference in that. Because when you're trying to create something that you think people are going to laugh at, they never will, because it's not coming from a really honest place. Anything, everything comes from the truth, for me. You know, and the truth can be hilarious, and science fiction can be based on truth, you know, and everything it is. So, like, how do you know it's funny? I've always said that if I think it's funny, if I would laugh at it, because in stand-up, you know, I'm writing everything, and then I go to a club, and I throw these ideas out, and then it becomes an episode of something, you know, and you just kind of go up there, and you're like, go with me on this. But I always learned that for you to trust what's funny, you really have to trust your voice and know that you got the idea for some reason. So you go with that, even though it generally doesn't maybe start like a good idea, or like maybe it sounds like a sad topic, you can make it hilarious because that you wanted to. You had that, you wanted to, and you know, that's what you do.
Up next, legal analyst and author Elie Mistal discusses his book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, with Professor Ivy Wilson. In this clip, Mistal shares insights into the many compromises written into the Constitution specifically to maintain slavery.
Think about it this way. Who wanted the three-fifths compromise? Who wanted to count African Americans, enslaved humans, as three-fifths of people? It was the South. The North wanted zero-fifths, right? They're enslaved. They don't have any rights. Why should they count for representation? The South, no, no, no. They wanted to count them as kind of people so they would have more representatives from Southern states in Congress. But they didn't want to count them as full people because that would be hypocritical. And so three-fifths became the compromise that the slavers wanted to secure their rights in Congress. I can't, like, it's hard to, when you really kind of break it down, it is just the cojones on these people, right? Just the hubris on these people to demand representation in government on the backs of people they were enslaving by counting those enslaved people as kind of quasi almost people-ish for the purposes of representation. That is the Three-Fifths Compromise. There are so many compromises written into the Constitution explicitly for the preservation of slavery. I've talked about the Second Amendment. We can talk about the Three-Fifths Compromise. I didn't bring it up in the book, but I wasn't thinking of it in these terms when I was writing it, but like there's a fugitive slave clause in the Constitution. Like people think of the Fugitive Slave Act as one of the incitements for the Civil War, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. That just enforced a clause that was literally already in this Constitution that that property had to be returned to its owner, right? So like concessions to our slaver racist past, and I haven't even gotten into the misogynist past, right? There are all these concessions to how this particular group of white, wealthy, landholding colonists wanted their country to be. They knew what they were trying to do. They were trying to erect a Western slave empire, and again, I can say a lot of negative stuff about them, but stupid is not one of them. They knew what they were doing.
Continuing the themes explored in our special exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice, author and professor Leonard Moore discusses his book, Teaching Black History to White People. In this clip, he explains the shortcomings of performative justice.
That's what we call performative justice. I mean, I don't know about you all, but I was getting emails every day from companies. Black Lives Matter from, what's the name of the big pet store in all these strip malls, what's it called?
Petco?
I don't even own a pet. And so that is what we call performative justice. And I'm losing my voice, here we go. There was a situation, and this gets to performative justice. There was a situation at the University of Texas Law School. They got about 3 black professors. Okay, so I got a call from the dean one day. He said, Leonard, we have an issue. Some students had a problem with a question on the exam. Black professor teaching a constitutional law class had an exam question. It just said, defend school segregation from a legal perspective. Now, I was always taught that a good lawyer could argue both sides of an argument. Mm-hmm. This is an intellectual exercise. Oh, the students were up in arms. Mm-hmm. So when the dean asked me to come over there and talk to the students, I said, I bet you it's going to be a room full of white students. Mm-hmm. I was wrong. It was 10 white students, 1 black student, and 1 Latino. And the ringleader was a 30-year-old white student. Oh, Leonard, Dr. Moore, that professor should be fired? He should never be able to give an exam again? If the university keeps him, all of his exams should go through some approval process? They were that upset over a question. And I asked the law professor and the dean to leave. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, this really upset y'all, huh? They said, yes. I said, how many law students did this school bring in this past year? They said, 296. I said, how many were black? I said, 7. So I said, so this is my issue. You are more upset about a question on the exam. But if you would ask black students what they want more black students in the school. And that is the kind of performative justice we got to check. Mm-hmm. Even with taking down some of the statues. Understand, if you ask black students on these campuses, what is removing the statues rank in rank order, they probably say number 8. But what happens in my issue with white liberals is that they often assume that they know what's best for black people, and they want to speak for black people. Listen to this. I live in Austin, Texas. There's a community, it's gentrified now, but 10 years ago, it was East Austin, an older black community. And I said, told my students that we're going to do something real radical. I said, let's sit in here and brainstorm about what you think the community needs. Better schools, recreational facilities, grocery store, all that stuff. I said, we're going to do something radical. We're going to go knock on the doors for 4 hours, and we're going to find out what they want. You know what they wanted? Number 1 was? They wanted speed bumps in the street. You know why? Because people flying through there trying to get to downtown, their kids were getting hit by cars. So the point is, you wouldn't know that unless you live there. And I tell white liberals all the time, the number one thing you can do is ask black folk, hey, what can I help you fight for?
Up next, acclaimed writers Ashley C. Ford and Eve L. Ewing discuss Ford's memoir, Somebody's Daughter. In this clip, Ford explains the process she went through to be able to trust her voice and her own story.
Anybody who heard me talk about the book I was writing in 2015, or even people who read the jacket copy, will be like, oh, you know, this book is going to be a lot about her relationship with her dad, who's incarcerated. But it's about his absence. Mm. It's not about, I try to tell people sometimes when, you know, I've heard that even as a critique, and I've just kind of been like, well, honey, if he was in prison, like,
he wasn't
there. Right, like, right, by definition, he wasn't there. Like, right. That's kind of the point. And one of the things I realized when I was writing the book was that I was trying really hard not to write me. I was trying really hard to write about my experience of other people, kind of, but it was about them. I wanted it to be about what was going on around me, and I didn't actually want my voice to really be part of it. And that was not working for a myriad of reasons. One, it's a memoir. The first two words are literally, like, the first word in memoir is me.
Yeah, and then, like, it's moi.
You know, and then it's more. So it's like I had to write about me. But also what I was realizing is that it was because I was still not owning my story.
Right,
like,
right.
It took me so long to recognize that just because my perception and my view of what was going on when I was 10 or 11 wasn't respected doesn't mean that it wasn't mine. Mm. And it doesn't mean that it wasn't accurate from my perception. And it didn't mean that I couldn't hold on to it as I didn't need anybody else's permission. I didn't need anybody else's version of it. I could trust myself. And that's really the through line, I think, of the process of writing the book from beginning to end, was that if this book taught me anything, it was that I can trust myself. Mm-hmm. I'm allowed. So yeah, that's pretty much like how that process went. It was like, how much can I trust me? How much do I trust me? And how much am I willing to share?
And finally, professor and historian Brooks E. Hefner discusses his book, Black Pulp, Genre Fiction in the Shadow of Jim Crow. In this clip, he explores how black newspapers and black pulp fiction writers reassemble genre formulas in the service of racial justice.
And he's publishing in the Pittsburgh Courier on a weekly basis. But then when I started looking at other major black news weeklies of the period, I discovered the Baltimore Afro-Americans doing the same thing, and even for longer, with more people, many, many more names, many, many more stories, more serials. And so essentially what came out of that research is this book, and it was a long process, but it was thinking about how we might understand genre and race and the way that they are intertwined. Because a lot of the genres that we, especially at this point, a lot of the genres that were the most popular genres were really steeped in racist stereotypes, right? I mean, we think about the Western, right, as a really good example of that. But other genres as well, sometimes overt, sometimes more, surreptitiously. And so what was really fascinating is to find all of these writers publishing their work in the Afro-American or the Pittsburgh Courier, who really seemed to understand how genre works, right? Like, what are the building blocks of a detective story? What are the building blocks of a romance story? But then to understand the problems with those formulas and imagine a way maybe to kind of reassemble those components to tell different kinds of stories that elevated black characters, that spoke to the desires of almost entirely black readership, right? And that kind of imagined, you know, how do we turn this inside out in a way, you know, as to promote a kind of agenda of racial justice? I start the book talking about Jordan Peele, who I think is a great example in the current moment of somebody who could take something like the horror story, and essentially, you know, a genre that also has a terrible not entirely, but a lot of it is a really racist history. And to say, like, how can we flip this? How can we flip the script a little bit and get a sense of, you know, the way that this genre might be used to expose the problems that are inherent in it?
Thank you for listening to this special episode from the AWM Podcast Network. We'll be off for a bit to rest up, but we'll be back in 2024 for another year full of conversations with contemporary authors and scholars. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.